This is the Jeff Merrick Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
So a couple of things about the Winnipeg Jets will face off against the Nashville Predators this evening. Playoff spot check, 100 points check. Hardware at the end of the season for individuals, most likely. What will they do in the playoffs? We shall see. It is the Preds and the Winnipeg Jets this evening as they chase down home ice advantage in the first round, 2 points away from the Colorado Avalanche for second in the Central. Kevin Cheveldayoff is the GM of the Winnipeg Jets, and he joins me now. Kevin, thanks so much for this. How are you today?
I'm doing well, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
The pleasure is mine. You know, we've talked to Rick Bowness a couple of different times, Elliot and I, this year for the 32 podcast. Yeah. And one of the things in our first conversation that we talked about was, you know, he really stressed this, was, you know, getting everything right. And those are difficult conversations. You know, when you sat down at the beginning of last offseason, you know, we wondered, okay, which direction is Winnipeg going to go here? The netminder's back, boom. Mark Scheifele is back, boom. And things start clicking at the beginning of the season. Pierre-Luc Dubois trade, etc. Good players on their way back. How difficult was that offseason for you? I don't know if we've talked about how much of a heavy lift that was for the Winnipeg Jets.
Well, you know, it was a methodical process. It wasn't one that obviously could simply just come to light, you know, instantly. And it began really, you know, at the end of last season and the conversations that we had, you know, with the players, with the staff, and then internally with, you know, with our own group and what the options might be in front of us as far as what directions we, you know, we could go. And obviously one thing led to another. And we were fortunate to be able to execute on a lot of the things that, you know, that we wanted to and get to the point that we're at now.
You know, it's been such a tremendous season for the Winnipeg Jets, and like every season, there's going to be a sort of a bunny hop element to it, a couple of steps forward and a couple of steps back here and there. But based on what you thought you had at the beginning of the season, like I just, you know, read off, after 77 games, it's, you know, locked into a playoff spot. That's been clinched, 100-point season. Some individuals have really distinguished themselves. Some younger players have popped. What were your expectations at the beginning of the season? You know, like sitting there saying, okay, on Tuesday, April the 9th, we expect blank. Yeah. What were your expectations?
Well, you know, obviously, I think, you know, it's shown here that this league is very hard to win in. And it's, you know, making the playoffs is a difficult proposition. You've got 82 games. It is a marathon. There's going to be lots of ups and downs. There's things that you just can't you can't prognosticate. You know, we've endured a couple of long-term injuries this year. You know, we lost, you know, Gabe Vilardi right out of the gate, essentially, with an injury early in the season. And so he's trying to get acclimated, you know, into the team, and you lose him. And then, you know, he comes back, you lose Kyle Connor, and then, you know, you lose Mark Scheifele for different periods of time. But those are the things, I guess, that, you know, that as a team you go through throughout the season, some of the struggles, some of the trials and tribulations, the ups and the downs, but it comes back to foundation. And I think that's what training camp is all about. And one thing, you know, obviously we lost Bones for a period of time there when Judy yep. got sick. And you know, again, it all these things test you. They test your organization. They test your preparation. They test your resilience. And they test your commitment to each other. And so that's what you need to get to the point that we're at here right now. But one thing for us is it's a process-driven thing with our team. We have to play a certain way to be successful. You know, we obviously have a tremendous goaltender. We've got lots of depth. But, you know, in order for us to be a successful team on a nightly basis, we have to play a certain way. And if you fall away from that in this league, it comes back and bites you. But it all comes back to the foundation that, you know, gets laid in place at training camp.
You know, you mentioned Gabe Vilardi there a couple of seconds ago, and, you know, I'm curious, you know, how far back your interest, boy, I'm going back all the way to the Pierre-Luc Dubois trade here, but here we go. You know, how far back did your interest in Gabe Vilardi stretch? Like, does it go back to OHL Windsor? Is it in the American Hockey League? Is it his shots up at the LA Kings level? Because that was, you know, you talk about, you know, injuries. You know, that's kind of a player that's kind of existed in stops and starts. And when he's in the lineup, as we all know, he's fantastic and dots down. He's one of my favorite players to watch in the NHL, and I'm not the only one there. But how far back did your interest go in Gabe Vilardi?
Well, certainly when we start talking about the player and you know, thinking that maybe this could be, you know, the basis of a deal that you're looking to make, you go back and read all the reports. You go back and read the reports from Junior, and you right. go back and talk to the amateur scouts. And you know, you talk about the, you know, the lost development time that he had at such a crucial age. We all know, you know, mm-hmm. again, development at 18, 19, 20, 21 are such crucial times. For young players, because they change so dramatically year over year. They get bigger, they get stronger. You know, they you know, hit walls and find out how to, you know, break down those walls. You know, so we knew, or at least we felt comfortable that, you know, Gabe was still on an upward trajectory, you know, with respect to development, because he's lost so much time and, you know, to the various different injuries that he's had. So that was an exciting part for us, obviously, and you know, you get a glimpse of seeing his skill level and obviously his hands and but you don't really appreciate his size and what he does until you're on his team. And I remember talking to Bones early in training camp, and he was just amazed at, you know, how big and powerful, you know, he is, and his willingness to go to the net, coupled with the talent and the hand, you know, that's a great combination. So hopefully, you know, again, some luck starts going Gabe's way when it comes to, you know, the injury side of things, and he can, you know, continue to develop for us.
I want to ask you about Cole Perfetti and how you think we should feel about where he's at right now. Now, understanding that, listen, your team's top six is really hard to break into, so that's not exactly a secret here, but given the performance that we've seen from Perfetti when he's in the lineup, how do you think we should feel about where Cole Perfetti is at right now?
Well, I think, you know, you want to talk about injuries. I think those things get kind of glossed over with respect to when we talk about Cole. Cole went through his own share of trials and tribulations. Obviously, 2 years ago, coming out of the, you know, the World Juniors, you know, looking to make his mark here in the National League. Unfortunately, he has an injury that shuts him down for the season. You know, again, last year, he gets to, you know, he's on a good trajectory. That happened again as well. So, you know, again, for us, we have a little bit of a different group this year. When we made the trade, we became a team with a lot more depth. We became more of a four-line type of team as opposed to a top six, bottom six that maybe we were constructed before. So, and that's how kind of Bones tries to coach. The whole theme and process for us is that every line kind of wants, you know, he wants every line to kind of look the same and play the same, because that's for us, you know, a part of our success. So you're going to see sometimes where, you know, maybe there's more skill on different lines and maybe matched up with you know, more of a checker on a different line. And there's more than one way to build lines. But a player like Cole Perfetti, you know, he's a really good young player that is, you know, obviously got tremendous amount of talent. His hockey sense is off the charts. You know, again, he's going to continue to grow to be a big, big part of, you know, us here. And for us to be successful in the playoffs here, it's going to take all of them. It's going to take, you know, everybody, you know, within our group here. And we obviously made some trades to increase our depth at the different positions here. And hopefully for us, we go on a long run, and guys like Cole are at the front and front center of it.
So you mentioned the deals, and I'm talking to Kevin Cheveldayoff, the general manager of the Winnipeg Jets. You mentioned a couple of deals, and we think of Sean Monahan, of course, and the Tyler Toffoli deal. Were these deals, I mean, every deal is unique, but were these deals that came together quickly? It seemed as if, you know, a lot of what New Jersey did when they realized that the season was going to be a challenge here, things started to come together. Did that one come together quickly, and how long were you working on the Monahan deal?
Well, the Monahan one obviously got accelerated right around the trade deadline. We had identified early internally here that we wanted to see if there was a center that we could acquire. And obviously, you don't know the timing of things, how that's going to work. Every other team, you know, works on their own timing and such. But obviously, with the Lindholm deal happening, it did accelerate the conversations that we had with Montreal on Sean. And that happened, you know, again, you know, I guess in terms relatively quickly, because, you know, once we identified what we wanted, we were pretty aggressive. And obviously, Montreal stood their ground on what they wanted from a price perspective. And, you know, we felt it was something that we needed to do at the time so that we could then establish ourselves and sit back and take a look and see, like, what opportunities might be out there as we got closer to the deadline. And with, you know, with Tyler, you know, again, New Jersey, I think it was still up in the air for quite a period of time for them on what they were going to do, or possibly even resign, you know, Tyler, from what I understand. So, you know, those things are done under the, I guess, you know, the pressures, but more so the accelerated time frame of the trade deadline, where once you, you know, once you get to that final day, then, you know, it's kind of like lay your cards on the table and see what happens from there.
Is there a player on your roster that you think either we've totally missed on, or we don't talk about enough? Like, Connor Hellebuck gets a lot of headlines, rightfully so.
Yeah.
Nick Ehlers and Mark Scheifele, et cetera. Cal Connor, for the obvious reasons. Josh Morrissey. Is there someone that you think that we've all missed on, or is not getting enough attention?
Well, you know, I think, you know, for our group, obviously, the top end players are very well known, and justifiably so, because they're, you know, they're good players in their own right, and they've earned, you know, all their opportunities. A lot of them have come through our organization and you know, drafted and developed. Some we've traded, you know, for, but you know, it's kind of the unsung heroes, I think, that that help you along the way. That, you know, again, a guy like Vladi Namestnikov, you know. When we started, you know, we moved him up to play, you know, in a position at center, probably higher in the lineup than he's played in a longer time, and he helped us, you know, stem, you know, a long period of time, whether it's through injuries or what, that, you know, we needed to move him around. But then obviously we make the trade for Monahan, and he gets put back on the fourth line, and he just goes and plays, you know, and then within a couple of days or whatever, we have an injury again, he's back in a different spot on the wing, you know. So it's that type of flexibility, I think, that, you know, when you sit back and evaluate as the season goes on, you need those kind of players that are kind of the Swiss Army knife type guys. Maybe don't, you know, get the headlines on each and every night, but can fill in different roles and different opportunities. The same with a guy like Alex Iafallo. Like, he's, you know, he's been asked to go, you know, in many different locations. And these guys are, you know, 500, 600, 700 game players in the National Hockey League, that you're asking them to sacrifice their own individual games for the greater good of the team, and they're willing to do that to win.
Let me ask you about two awards specifically in conclusion here. One, I've mentioned this a couple of different places. I don't think it's a secret that you're going to get a lot of consideration for the Jim Gregory Award, the General Manager of the Year. Now, that is voted on by the general managers. Are you allowed to vote for yourself? Would you vote for yourself? And if not, who would you consider?
Well, you know, again, it is something that, you know, as you go on, I think the voting for that particular award is done after the second round. So they take second into round. Consideration yeah. some playoffs and the like. And I was fortunate to, you know, be up for the award in, I think, 17, 18. And, yeah, you know, again, it's an honor to even, you know, have that kind of conversation. But there's lots of guys that have done, you know, tremendous jobs. And, you know, again, you kind of look around the league and you know, you can see, you know, guys even like here, we're playing in Nashville tonight. I think Barry Trotz has done a great job of, you know, of slowly yeah. kind of, you know, maneuvering the franchise around here to where, you know, where it's at. Obviously, Jim Nill, you know, with Dallas won it last year. But, you know, again, just, you know, yep. teams that have done, you know, fabulous, fabulous jobs. And, you know, you can kind of go on and on and on. You know, but sure. You know, C-Mac in Colorado, there he's done a fabulous job, and
yeah.
all these teams. And I guess I'm kind of talking about our division because it's you know, for us, that's what we play on a regular basis. You know, so it's kind of like sure. You know, a tough you know, tough grind for us. But you know, there's a lot of good managers that you know, are really deserving, and it's hard. It's hard to make quick changes, and sometimes the changes don't really. Yeah. you know, come into play until maybe a year or two, if it's a younger player or, you know, but you got to be in lockstep with your coaches and they, you know, they have to, you know, buy in as well. So that's a long winded answer to say that, you know, I don't know.
Well, you're going to be in consideration. I'm sure you're going to get plenty of votes. The other one I want to ask you about, is it a lock that for the Vezina, you will vote for Connor Hellebuck?
I tell you what, you know, one thing as a manager, you learn is that if you're blessed with a goaltender that can give you a chance to win on a nightly basis, you sleep much better at night. And we're very, very fortunate to have, you know, Connor in our organization.
Yeah.
And if I could vote multiple times for him, I would. And you know, he is our backbone. There's no question about it. And you know, the day that we signed him, and the day that we, you know, were able to extend him and Scheife, you know, that's a day for me that I'm going to remember for a long, long time, because you know, not only from just, you know, how monumental it was for the organization, but just the conversations that I had with the two of them, and how important it was to want to win a Stanley Cup, and how important it was to want to win a Stanley Cup in Winnipeg.
It looks like this is very much his trophy to lose. Kevin, thanks as always for this. Best of luck against the Preds tonight. Best of luck in the postseason with your Jets. Much appreciated.
Thanks very much.
There he is, Kevin Cheveldayoff, the general manager of the Winnipeg Jets. All right, folks, time now, speaking of the Winnipeg Jets, time now for Line Change, presented by Sports Interaction, your homegrown sports book, Bet Local. And I know, Matt Marchese, you're feeling Winnipeg, Nashville tonight.
Yeah, it's a big one. I mean, one team trying to get home ice, the other one trying to lock down a playoff spot. It's a lot of fun. It's the Jets at the Predators, right? This one in Nashville. Hopefully Morgan Wallen is not throwing any chairs off of any buildings near the arena. Puck line is Jets minus 1.5. The under has hit in 4 of the last 6 between these two in Nashville, and 5 of the last 7 overall. Nashville is 5-1 straight up in their last 6 at home.
So, as you mentioned, the Bridgestone Arena here, it's the Preds and the Jets. And as you mentioned, the Nashville Predators looking to clinch a playoff spot. They need 1 point, and they've locked it up. Okay. The Jets have a 6-point cushion on third. Nashville is chasing. Probably not enough runway there. A couple of things I want to mention here with the Nashville Predators. Roman Josi, I know we've talked about him as maybe like a hipster Hart Trophy candidate here. But what he's been able to do this season, I don't think should be lost on anybody. And what he's been able to do is not just individually impress and get himself in the conversation for the Norris Trophy, but also brought this team to a point where they're a lock to make the playoffs and maybe even do some damage there. And here's one for you. For a defenseman 33 years and older, Roman Josi is tied with Matthew Schneider for most goals in a season with 21. Winnipeg Jets, by the way, 2 points back of Colorado for home ice in the first round. Gus Nyquist, watch this guy. Maybe the comeback player of the season, with all due respect to Jonathan Drouin, 71 points. Philip Forsberg, by the way, just another great season. Casual, 43 goals and 89 points. This is a recording. And that was Line Change, presented by Sports Interaction, your homegrown sports book. Bet local. It is Winnipeg. It is Nashville tonight. A busy schedule around the NHL. We'll get into all of it here in a couple of seconds with Matt Marchese. Also, hour two, bottom of the hour, Scott Burnside, the future of hockey in Atlanta, discussed, debated, chewed up, coming up in hour two.
Everything Raptors, before and after the games. The Raptor Show with Will Liu. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. This is the Jeff Merrick Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Welcome back to the program here Monday to Friday, noon to 2 Eastern, across the Sportsnet Radio Network, Sportsnet 360, and wherever you find your fine podcasts, folks, you will find this offering. Scott Burnside coming up at the bottom of the hour. Interesting piece that he penned a piece, or she penned a piece. No one writes anything anymore. He typed an interesting piece on his laptop that's published the other day at sportsnet.ca about the future of hockey in Atlanta. And, you know, the history of hockey in Atlanta, certainly the NHL, stretches back into the early 70s with the Flames, and then, of course, in the Southeast Division with the Thrashers and the one playoff appearance against the New York Rangers, where it seemed that Ilya Kovalchuk, who was the star of the Atlanta Thrashers at that point, was more concerned with chasing Sean Avery all over the ice for 4 games than he was in actually trying to win a game for the Atlanta Thrashers. But I digress. And there are competing bids to bring a team back to Atlanta. Scotty's all over all of it. lives there and knows the market well. We'll talk to Burnside coming up at the bottom of the hour. In the meantime, Matt Marchese, you want to go over some clinching scenarios here and just sort of get these out of the way?
Sure. By the way, I noticed that you used my pen the piece, and that's what you were commenting on. So I will no longer put pen the piece in the lineup.
Oh, did you write that in the rundown?
See, now I know you don't even read my rundowns, Jeff. What's going on here?
I'd like to insult you twice.
The subliminal shot. That's good.
That one.
That's good. That's okay.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. Let's do the clinching. Let's do the clinching scenario.
So Pred, so mentioned before the top of the hour there, before the top of the hour break, and thanks to Kevin Cheveldayoff for stopping by the program today, and thanks to the Winnipeg Jets for making him available. It's the Preds and the Winnipeg Jets at Bridgestone today. Preds will clinch a playoff spot if they get at least 1 point against the Jets. This thing is close. Let's face it, Nashville has had this playoff spot locked up for a while now. This is more of a formality. Los Angeles Kings will clinch a playoff berth if they defeat the Ducks tonight in any fashion. So just win and you're in. That's all you got to do, L.A. The Rangers will clinch the Metropolitan Division title if they defeat the Islanders. They're playing the Islanders a couple of times here coming up. Defeat the Islanders in any fashion, and the Carolina Hurricanes lose to the Boston Bruins. Those are two tasty games right there.
In regulation.
Rangers, Islanders.
Clarification on that one. They have to lose in regulation.
In regulation, yeah. I should point that. Hurricanes and the Bruins in regulation. And Hurricanes in Boston is a great matchup as well. Mm-hmm. Some great games tonight. Bruins, by the way, will clinch the Atlantic Division title if they defeat the Hurricanes in any fashion and both of the following occur. You writing this down? If you're driving, I hope not. The Maple Leafs lose to the Devils in any fashion. The Panthers lose to the Senators in regulation. The Dallas Stars will clinch the Central if they defeat the Sabres in any fashion, and both of the following occur. The Avs have to lose to the Wild in regulation, and the Jets have to lose to the Predators in regulation. Everybody got that?
We good.
We could see some divisions wrapped up, and both the Preds and the Kings could make it formal, make it official, put a ring on it, and make the playoffs tonight. How's it going, Maddie?
I'm good. I went because you know how the brain sometimes works when you have a little bit of time and you're looking through different things. And, you know, I mentioned yesterday about, like, if there was a team that, you know, if you had to pick a team in the West, like, okay, maybe it's Nashville. I was looking at Nashville's schedule. Do you know when the Nashville Predators finish their regular season schedule, Jeffrey?
Let me cheat. Oh wow, the 15th. They got a rest. Woo! Dude, they got a game on. Holy smokes!
Yeah. So
yeah, they got a nice rest.
So
man.
Do you want? I don't want to play them anymore. I take it back. I don't want to play them anymore because that's a long time to get healthy. Rested. Like people will say, "Oh, there's the rest versus rusting." No. At this time of the year, them having 4 days off is probably a really good thing. And there's the potential that they may not even play Saturday. They may play Sunday for their first game of the playoffs, depending on how it works out. But, you know, a team like the Vancouver Canucks, which is a very, very good possibility that that's who they play Thursday.
Against Winnipeg.
Yeah, and that's not an easy game either, because Winnipeg could be playing for something here. Vancouver could be playing for something. More so, you know, the President's Trophy rather than the division. But, I don't know. That's a really good
Winnipeg
thing for Nashville.
Playing for second place. That is. That's good. That's good. When you look at, although, listen, when you look at the Western Conference, like, honestly, I've made this point before. Normally in a conference, you can look at it and say, okay, if I could pick the team that I played, there's two in the Eastern Conference.
Yeah.
Not necessarily teams, because who knows who's going to end up there. But third in the Metropolitan and wild card two.
Yep.
Now, I don't know, but again, I say to myself, you might not know now, Merrick, but just like you didn't know Florida last year, because none of us did. I don't know that I see a Florida Panthers this year.
Well, find me the team that won find me the team that's in one of those precarious positions, and find me the team that won the President's Trophy the year before, and I will tell you that there is no Florida Panthers. They do not exist.
I don't know. I don't know if there's a team that's going to go on a Florida Panthers run here.
Oh, speaking of...
If they get in, hang on.
If they get in,
could you see a team like the Detroit Red Wings doing that? Now, they do have a goalie overlap in Alex Lyon, but I can't see the Detroit Red Wings doing that.
No. Not with that defense. Sorry. Not happening.
Yeah.
So, no, I don't. There's no team that exists like that. No, you know who that team is, Jeff? It's the Vegas Golden Knights in the West. Mm. That's who the team is. That's in the West.
Defending Stanley Cup champs.
Yeah. Well, they're wild card one. Actually, they're two right now. So
wild card two, right?
Yeah,
now,
yeah. So that's the only team. But I wanted to ask you something about Nashville and just talking about Florida there and Nashville.
Sure.
Andrew Burnett's going to be up for Coach of the Year, we think, after the way that, you know, a lot of people didn't think that they were going to be here. Do you think that Andrew Brunette got the raw end of the deal because, A, he took over for Joel Quenneville when they won the President's Trophy and people were like, well, the team was already ready. You know, you just got to open the door. And then, you know, they lose in the first round to a team like Tampa Bay who was already seasoned. Yep. We already know that situation. And then he gets an assistant coaching job with New Jersey. Then he gets the head coaching job with Nashville. Do you think that he was just overlooked a little bit because of what happened in Florida in that he took over for a coach that didn't get fired because of the performance on the ice? It was the circumstances, which we all know, and we don't need to get into it. But Andrew Brunette's one of those guys that he's a good coach, but people thought, well, maybe he's not that good of a coach because he took over a good team. Now we're seeing it. Now there's absolutely no doubting that Andrew Brunette's a really good coach.
I mentioned yesterday on the show, one person who knows him quite well, you know, talked to me on the, was it last weekend or the weekend before, and said, like, nobody has better face-off plays than Andrew Brunette. He's got like a million of them. Like, I know all teams go into the face-off with a plan. We have, this is what we do if this, and this is what we do. This one person said to me, you're not going to find anybody that's got more face-off plays than Andrew Brunette. Like, he is ready for all of it. And that's always been one of his strengths. With Florida, I think that was one of the hardest things he could have done.
Okay.
Right? I mean, that team at that point was so, had the potential to be so fragile after Joel Quenneville got punted.
Yeah. Like
the whole thing could have totally gone off the track. That whole thing could have been driven in the ditch. And Andrew Brunette very much kept it on the road. And that's why he was a finalist for the Jack Adams. Now, the situation in New Jersey was an interesting one with Brunette because I think a lot of people thought, and maybe it was just that 13-game winning streak that saved Lindy Ruff's job. I think everyone thought that they were going to go with Lindy Ruff until, you know, maybe the first major losing streak, and then Andrew Brunette was going to take over the New Jersey Devils.
Yeah.
Like, the assistant coach was sitting there just waiting, and then that didn't happen. And all of a sudden, you know, New Jersey made the playoffs, and New Jersey upset the New York Rangers, et cetera, et cetera. And then, you know, the Nashville Predators made their move with Andrew Brunette in what really is, again, like, we'll talk about, you know, GM of the Year here in a second. But like, that, if you're going to vote for GM of the Year, you look at all the hires, you look at all the trades, both bringing people in and sending people out as well. I mean, that's a great one. That is a great one for the Nashville Predators.
Yeah.
And if anybody knows coaches, it's Barry Trotz. He's a smart coach. There's no denying it. He's a well-prepared coach, and he's taken this Nashville Predators team to a place that I don't think any of us thought that they would get to. And you know what? If he ends up winning Coach of the Year, and listen, John Tortorella has taken himself out of this now. What have we been saying all year long? It's Tocchet and Torts, Tocchet and Torts, Tocchet and Torts. I still think that Rick Tocchet ends up getting Coach of the Year. But Andrew Brunette should be right there in that conversation. And if somehow Andrew Brunette gets Coach of the Year in the acceptance speech, there has to be some reference to U2 or his walk-up music to accepting the award. It has to be like, you know, Streets Have No Name or something like that. Streets Have No Name. You got something U2, because that's been the demarcation point. Like, forever that Andrew Brunette is in the NHL behind a bench, he will always have in his Wikipedia the U2 story about getting scotched by the Dallas Stars and canceling the entire team, not just the team, right? Not just the players, but everybody around as well, the early trip to Vegas to go see U2. That is going to become part of the lore of Andrew Brunette.
Yeah. I would agree with that.
Excellent coach.
Yeah, it's just great on Andrew Brunette. It's just a shame that we're not going to have two coaches of Italian heritage in the finalists for Coach of the Year, Jeff.
That bothers you, I know.
And ball hockey, they've got it covered. The Italians and the Portuguese have it covered. The NHL is still trying to conquer it.
Man. We used to, when I played Ontario Ball Hockey, in the Ontario Ball Hockey Association, this is like mid-90s, we were a pretty good team until we faced off against a team that was all Italians.
Yeah.
Because they're good hockey players, but they're just great runners because they all play soccer.
They just can't skate.
They are such good runners. They can, oh man, they would just run us into the ground. We hated it.
Our pal Mike Fiuta is a fantastic ball hockey player, by the way.
Futsis? I didn't know
that.
Yeah,
he was I heard all the stories from my old man. He used to play against him. Yep.
No way.
Yeah, some pretty incredible stuff.
Well, Terry Ryan, outstanding ball hockey player, and I always go out of my way because we saw this in a very famous goal, which we've called the ball hockey goal. Alex Burrows.
Yes, Alex Burrows was
ball
fantastic.
Hockey player for the longest time in that game against Chicago Blackhawks, jumping up, grabbing the puck, throwing it down and one timing the shot.
Like, yeah.
Matty, you play ball hockey. That's a ball hockey goal, man.
It sure is.
The moment I saw it, I'm like, can you tell Alex Burrows played ball hockey? It's a total ball hockey goal.
Can I give a quick former NHLer playing ball hockey story that was passed on to me, which is actually quite hilarious? You'll appreciate this because you know.
So you've got your Sam Gagner fed you a pass.
This has nothing
Sam
to do with
Gagner
me.
A pass and a tryout.
Yeah, this has nothing to do with me.
Oh, okay, go.
No, so. Sean Burke played ball hockey and he went
as
in
goalie.
He went in net for, I don't know if it was just one game. I think it was just one game by the sounds of it. And I think it was against a team that my dad played on. They scored three goals on him, like in short order. And he went to, and one of them was like the ball had dipped. You know what happens? You take a slap shot. The ball does really funny things. Apparently, Sean Burke went to the bench, took off his gear, and said, I'm never playing again. This was like a few minutes into the game. Said, I'm never playing in net again in ball hockey. And he didn't.
I remember, I'll tell you another goalie story here, although it's not just a goalie here. I remember playing roller hockey, and this would have been, can't remember the exact year here. But I was playing roller hockey, and when Wade Bielak played with the Toronto Maple Leafs, I got to know him pretty well. And so I was playing on a team that Michael Landsberg was coaching, him and his son, Corey. And we were playing in a tournament, and we were like, you know what? We need a goaltender. Let's see if Wade will come out. Not to play because, like, ringer alert, we're bringing in an NHLer. But Wade's like, I'll play net for you guys. He goes, can I just wear like regular shoes? I'm like, yeah, sure, of course. Like, why not? So we're all waiting for Wade Bielak to show up, the late, great, what a wonderful person he was, Wade Bielak. And so we're all waiting for Wade to show up. Me and Landsberg, you know, Michael and Corey are sitting around like, okay, like, you're going to be late here. So Wade pulls up with about 10 minutes before the game starts. And he's like, sorry, guys, I had to go to the rink at the Air Canada Center. I had to go to the Air Canada Center to get goalie equipment. And he shows up with Trevor Kidd stuff. And this is like after Trevor Kidd was ex of the Toronto Maple Leafs. And he's putting on his gear. I'm like, is that? And he's like, yeah, this is Trevor Kidd stuff. I had to go to the rink, and I grabbed Trevor Kidd stuff out of the dressing room. And I'm like, should you have done that? He's like, he's not going to need this anymore in Toronto. He's done. He just grabbed all of Trevor Kidd's gear to come play roller hockey in some tournament in North York.
That's amazing.
Anyway, that's a wonderful Wade Bielak story. Boy, do I ever miss Wade Bielak. What a nice, nice man he was.
Yeah.
Oh, boy, was he a good guy. You know what? One thing I want to plug here. Hang on, let me grab this. I'm going to start reading this tonight because we have him as a guest.
On Thursday.
Yeah, Joe Watson. So I got a copy, if you're watching on Sportsnet 360, Joe Watson, Philadelphia Flyers defenseman, played with the Boston Bruins as well. Thundermouth, Memoirs of a Broad Street Bully and NHL Lifer. This is the Joe Watson story, whether it's with the Philadelphia Flyers, whether it's playing, you know, Stanley Cup Finals, and he was on two of those Stanley Cup teams of the Philadelphia Flyers in 74 and 75. I am so like, you know, there are some teams, Matty, that for the rest of your life, you will read anything about those teams. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, for a lot of people, it's those Oilers teams of the 80s. And I'm one of them too. Like, I'll read anything on that Oilers team from any perspective, from anyone who was there, anyone who covered it. I'll read Oilers books. The Islanders dynasty, ditto. Anything from the Jean Béliveau era of the Montreal Canadiens, I'm all over it. But that Philadelphia Flyers team is special.
Yeah.
You know, some of my earliest memories, you know, sitting on my cousin's couch in Livonia, Michigan, as like a 5 or 6 year old. It's my earliest memories. We're sitting there watching Philadelphia Flyers games. Why were what? What's been playoffs? Watching the Philadelphia Flyers in Livonia, Michigan. But I've always been fascinated by that team. Always really been fascinated by Fred Shiro. Never had a chance to meet Fred, but have certainly, you know, talked to his son, Ray Shiro, a number of times, often about his dad, who to me was one of the greatest coaches and one of the most interesting personalities to ever be in the NHL. But I will read anything written by any member of the Broad Street Bullies crew. Do you have a team like that for you that you will read or watch anything? Is there, do you have like a set team? Like, I cannot get enough information about this team. For me, it's that 70s Flyers team.
The mid-90s Red Wings for me. Because that was an era that even spanned into the early 2000s. Steve Yzerman was my favorite player growing up. And you know, the Russian Five and all that. Like, mm-hmm. I remember that. It's those teams you talk about at impressionable ages too, right? Like, I would have been whatever I was, 7, yeah. 8 years old, 9 years old. So those were the teams that you remember. What I would love to see and hear, I would love a documentary on the, and we talk about this all the time, the 96 World Cup of Hockey. That's what I want. I want a documentary on that. That's what I want.
You would have had one by now if Canada had won.
100%.
And I know this is a very unpopular opinion, but as much as we talk about how great the play was in 1987 in that Canada Cup, and it was. Like, that was, I remember watching every single game. Like, this is the best hockey I've ever seen in my life. 96 is just as good.
It's nasty too. It's like nasty.
And it is nasty. I know it's nasty. It's dirty. It's yeah.
There's fights.
It is too. But we don't. I know it's great. We don't talk about 96 because Canada didn't win.
Nah, that's ridiculous.
But if Canada had won in 96, would we be talking a lot more about it?
Of course we would. Of course.
The quality of hockey was just as good as 87.
It was amazing. That's why I wish there was a documentary on it, because I would love to get the players' perspectives on that too, because that was international hockey at a physical level like we haven't really seen. Like, it was a different world.
Yeah, it was good.
So I did want to, because we're gonna get short on time here, but I did want to talk to you about, couple things. Hopefully we can get to both, but if we don't, whatever. We can talk about the next thing another day. This year, it's kind of an anomaly in that there's the potential that the Hart Trophy, Art Ross Trophy, and Ted Lindsay Trophy winners are not the same person. You could potentially have 3 different winners of those awards, which for my account has never happened, because usually if you win the Art Ross, you get the Hart Trophy or you get the Lindsay before it was the Lester B. Pearson Trophy. This year, it could be a combination of 3 different players that win those awards. How much, like, I mean, it's a little bit of a long shot, but if Nikita Kucherov doesn't win the Art Ross, I could see him not winning the Hart, but absolutely winning the Ted Lindsay Award.
So the Ted Lindsay Award, for those who don't know, that Maddie's talking about, is voted on by the players. And I thought John Cooper, mind you, he's talking about his own player, but still, I think you brought up a great point the other day on the program. Was it 2 weeks ago we had Coop on?
Yeah, something like that.
And he said, Nikita Kucherov is the player that other players watch.
Yeah.
He's the one that other players just sort of shake their head at and like, how did he do that? Like, listen, we all love watching Connor McDavid. We all love watching Nathan MacKinnon. But then there are the players. Like, you ask anyone who played at the time of Marian Hossa, for example. I think Hossa's a good example.
Mm-hmm.
Marian Hossa, in a lot of ways, did things that all the players marveled at consistently. Like, even just the way that he held the stick with his hands up high, the way that he was able to take any pass. Like, I've always gone out of my way to mention this about Marian Hossa. Part of the greatness about Marian Hossa, you could throw garbage at him. Didn't matter.
Yeah.
Like, you know the old saying, you can't give a great player a bad pass? What it means is, doesn't matter. Throw a bad pass, that player can take it if they're a great player. That was Marian Hossa.
Kucherov the same.
You know, one of the great underrated skills that we don't talk about, I think, is your ability to take bad passes.
Yeah.
because we all, and listen, you're a coach. You do, I'm sure you do. You scream at players for making bad passes in practice. I've always looked at bad passes as part of practice because you're not going to get clean. You're not going to get clean passes in games. And Hossa had, for my money, maybe the best ability to just pick up garbage. You could throw anything just around Marian Hossa, and he'd be able to take it. Nikita Kucherov is kind of those one of those guys. He does all the things that players look at and say, wow, how does he do that? I wish I could do that. How did he see that? Or the one that I always like, which I mean, you can make the point about Ovechkin and the one-timer, makes plays that we've seen him make a million times, but he still surprises us with them,
yeah,
with that play. And you know what I'm talking about? You know that play where he gets a pass and looks like he's taking a one-timer, but passes it to the slot?
Yeah.
Right
at the perfect pace.
How many times have you seen that play?
100.
Easily 100, probably more.
Yeah.
I've seen that play, same as you. I still pop. I always go like, whoa. And I catch myself like, Merrick, what are you doing? You've seen that play so many times. Like, why should you be surprised? But I still am.
Yeah.
That's one of the best things about the game, watching Kucherov make that play. But he's the guy that the players all love watching. I think Cooper's right on the money about that.
So I think the interesting thing with Kucherov and in that conversation is he also plays the game at a totally different pace than those other two guys. Like, those other two guys are burners, right? When we talk about McDavid, we talk about McKinnon. So, and not that Kucherov's not a great skater, but he plays the game at whatever pace he wants to. Not breakneck. It's whatever he wants to do.
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, we've had this conversation about other players as well, but he doesn't make He doesn't make the smart play. He doesn't make the right play, makes the smart play.
Mm-hmm.
And he is just so cerebral.
They used to say about Mitch Marner, scouts would talk about him and say he doesn't make the right play, he makes the better play.
That's what it is.
He makes the play that you think you think initially, oh, don't do that. Okay.
Well, that worked.
Oh, I didn't see that. Okay, I'll just shut up now.
Yeah.
But right away, your instinct is like, no, Marner, don't. Okay. Oh,
yeah. All
right.
That's why the guy's a perennial 90-point scorer.
Yeah.
Kind of good.
The thing about Kucherov and his pace. So I have a theory on this one.
Okay.
So my theory about Kucherov and the pace that he plays at is kind of like, and again, I'm not saying he's Mario Lemieux, but the best player doing this was Mario Lemieux. Mario Lemieux could play at whatever pace he wanted, because players were afraid to challenge him one-on-one.
I think that's fair.
Didn't want to go near him, because how many times did you see Mario make someone look bad? Spinning jock strap at the dot. How many times did you see that? A lot.
Mm-hmm.
Mario was the best at it. That's part of his brilliance. Like, Mario could play however he wanted because guys were afraid to challenge him one-on-one or check him one-on-one because of what he would do. I kind of get the same vibe about Kucherov, that there's the, I'm not going to get too close here because I might get bit element about Kucherov, that let him play at his own pace. You're like, just go and play at your own pace and no one's going to approach you because they've seen you make so many players look like Pavel Datsyuk was that way too, man. Like, I still marvel and I still shake my head at that Logan Couture play. How many times have you seen the Logan Couture highlights with Pavel Datsyuk? Again, hundreds. And you still shake your head at it. But Datsyuk was able to play at his own pace. Because after Alex Kovalev was allowed to play at his own pace. Because after a while, players just started to say, you know what? I'm just going to try to contain here. I'm not going to try to challenge because I don't need to end up on a highlight reel.
Interesting you mentioned two other Russian players there.
The kids say. Well, highly skilled, right? Not exactly a secret.
Yep.
But you're right. Like, McKinnon and McDavid are burners. The way that I describe about Kucherov and Nathan McKinnon smashes down the front door and Nikita Kucherov slips in the side door.
Yeah. Very
fair. They both score. They just do it different ways. But I could see Kucherov winning the Lindsay. I could see McDavid winning the Art Ross, and I could see Nathan McKinnon winning the Hart.
And we may never see something like that again.
Thought on some of the... Maybe. Who knows? I mean, every year the league gets kind of freakier. There's some dark horses here. I always throw Connor Hellebuck into this conversation. But then again, I always throw goaltenders in the hard conversation because by definition of the trophy itself, it kind of screams goaltender, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. 100%.
Most valuable to his team. That to me screams goalie, and I know a lot of people scream back, well, they already have the Vezina. Well, does that mean we don't give it to defensemen either because they have the Norris?
Yeah.
Forwards have the Sulky. You know, you can make a case, I think, for Austin Matthews, 70 goals or not. He's getting close here. There are many that we'll talk about, like Elliot goes out of his way to mention Artemi Panarin.
And Sidney Crosby.
And rightfully so. There are others that will go out of their way to mention Sidney Crosby and David Pastrnak. Like, this is the most wide open I think we've seen the Hart Trophy in a long time.
Yeah, because usually...
And...
Yeah. Usually the Art Ross is just linked to the Hart Trophy too, right? Generally, if you have a really good offensive season, you win the Art Ross, you're kind of just like... Or you get handed the Lindsay, right? This year, it's just so tight, and each guy has their own little... Like, McDavid, 100 assists. Kucherov has 40 more points than the next guy. Nathan MacKinnon with the home scoring streak and how many, you know, just how consistent he's been all year. Everybody has their own little thing. Boston Matthews scores 70 goals. He's in the conversation, right? So it's just super interesting. I think it's, Jeff, we talk about it all the time. We pray for chaos and we look for chaos. Three different major award winners, chaos. I love it.
You know what else is wide open this year? The Sulky.
Yeah, because Patrice Bergeron's retired.
We talked about it all year. Bergeron's gone. Like, woo, okay, here we're going to go. And it's going to go to Barkov. Jordan Staal is going to be in the conversation too. Norris, I mean, the closer we get here to the end of the season, it's more apparent as the conversations start to heat up that this is going to be Quinn Hughes's. And, you know, the battle is for number two. Vezina, Connor Hellebuyck, and... I always go out of my way when we're talking about awards, and I'm going to do it again. Do the right thing and give Marc-Andre Fleury the Lady Bang.
Is that
the most gentlemanly player?
If they give that to him, does it not feel like a lifetime achievement award? Like, is that what we're kind
of... Sort of, yeah. I just think it's a fitting... Okay. First of all, it'll be the first goaltender to ever win the Lady Bang.
Yeah, and if there ever was one, it's him.
Is a goaltender allowed to win the Lady Bing? Yes. Has a goaltender ever won the Lady Bing? No. So it would be a first. And I just think it would be a wonderful way to send Marc-Andre Fleury off, if this is indeed his final season, to give him the most gentlemanly player award. Listen, he's someone that everybody has loved since he joined the National Hockey League. Like, even when he played with the Pittsburgh Penguins, even if you're a Philadelphia Flyers fan, there's been enough time now that you can look back and say, yeah, you know what? Flower was great.
No, Flyers fans won't do that. You know that.
Come on. Even with hindsight, 2020.
No chance. No chance. No, they'd have to hand in their Flyer card if they did that.
I don't know about that one. You can certainly, even if you're a Flyer fan, you can appreciate the greatness that was Marc-Andre Fleury. I really think you can. And what a great way to send him off. Give him the Lady Bing. Never been done before. Give it to Marc-Andre Fleury. Comes up for one more award and does something historical.
I'm trying to look at his
penalty. You know you like it, man.
He does have four penalty minutes, Jeff. I don't know if he's going to qualify.
Tried to fight Jordan Binnington last year, too. So
I know.
What? I don't think the fact that you have a fight should disqualify you, though.
By the way, I'm just looking at his Hockey DB page. He had 50 penalty minutes one year in Cape Breton.
Yeah.
His first year in Cape Breton.
Oh, yeah. He fought. I think he had two or maybe three fights in the QMJHL.
I don't know, Jeff.
Fleury was feisty in senior, man.
Is this a Stan Mikita-type scenario here, Jeff? Where we're talking...
Now the reference there, if you don't know, Stan Mikita came in as a crusher and then turned into a finesse player. I think a lot of that was spurned on by conversations with his daughter.
Interesting.
Why is daddy fighting?
That's very interesting. Yeah,
and then he just went on to become one of the most prolific Chicago Blackhawks we've ever seen. Scott Burnside is coming up here in a couple of seconds, Matt. We're going to talk about Atlanta. Do you have a quick thought on? Listen, I think we know by now, like. We know this is going to happen eventually. You have a quick thought on Atlanta before Scotty joins us here.
I don't know how this is going to work again. Like, we've gone down this road twice already, and it hasn't worked. And I get it. If you have stable ownership, that's fine. Right. But people still got to go to the games. I know the NHL wants to be in the big markets. My biggest question is, and this is more of a big picture thing, but what does the NHL value more, Salt Lake City or Atlanta? Like, this, you know, there's the stable ownership there in Salt Lake City. They've made the NBA work. I wonder which one they, if they had, if they needed the truth serum, which one they would prefer. And I feel like the answer is Atlanta.
You know what the real answer is?
Neither. Arizona. Both. Yeah.
And both will be in.
34
games. Scott Burnside joins us here in a couple of moments. Merrick Show continues. Expansion's coming. Maybe relocation's coming. Scott Burnside is going to stop by talking to us about the future of hockey at the NHL level in Atlanta. Stay tuned for this conversation. Flames, Thrashers, Team X. We'll see what happens. Merrick Show continues across the Sportsnet Radio Network, simulcast on Sportsnet 360 and wherever you get your podcasts. Back in a moment.
Covering the Blue Jays from an analytical perspective. Jays Talk Plus with Blake Murphy. Be sure to subscribe and download Jays Talk on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. This is the Jeff Merrick Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
And this segment of the Jeff Merrick Show is brought to you by Hyundai. Welcome back to the program across the Sportsnet Radio Network, simulcast on Sportsnet 360. Pleased to be in conversation with Scott Burnside, a longtime NHL writer, reporter, journalist, has covered the league for a number of years and seen teams in Atlanta come and go. And maybe now we'll see a return. The winds are certainly blowing in that direction. A great piece that Scott wrote recently, available at sportsnet.ca. Scotty, how are you today? Thanks so much for being aboard again.
Absolutely. My pleasure to be here. In fact, if I showed you my camera, I'm in Decatur on the east side of Atlanta. I've already staked out the ground for what I hope will be the new practice facility for NHL 3 here in Atlanta. That's my name, though. No one else is calling it that.
I like that. Are there shovels? Are we getting anything going here? Anything, any announcements on the horizon here? This is all speculative at this point, Scotty.
Yes, and certainly no announcement on the practice facility here in Decatur. But no, it's early days, I would say. Although,
yeah,
as we know from the NHL's recent expansion plans and certainly the successes in Vegas and Seattle, once things start to move, there is a tendency if the ducks are aligned, if the stars are aligned, that it can move very quickly. In a different part about Atlanta here, you have two groups who have made it very clear to the NHL and to the local business and sporting community that they would like to bring the NHL back to Atlanta. Two different groups, one led by Vernon Krause, an automotive philanthropist. He staked out a piece of land north of the perimeter highway here. And, of course, Anson Carter, longtime NHLer, one of the important faces of equity in the NHL, and of course the TNT national broadcast here, not far from downtown Atlanta, of course, part of a group that would like to put an arena complex in the North Point Mall area, a little bit closer to the perimeter highway, but still north of downtown.
You know, you mentioned TNT there a second, Scotty. And before we get to the can hockey work in Atlanta conversation, I do want to ask about TNT. And listen, they're obviously, as we know, anchored in Atlanta. And I don't think that this is a fact that we should just shrug off or look at frivolously. I mean, I look at this situation and I say, listen, the NHL has a significant relationship with TNT. In a lot of ways, it just flat out makes sense that if there's interest in a team in Atlanta, considering one of their primary partners is anchored in Atlanta, that they should have a team in Atlanta. I know it's not the primary reason, but on the sort of, you know, rungs of the ladder of why there should be a team there, where do you put the presence of TNT?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting element, and I know having had a conversation, well, Anson Carter and I have had a number of conversations over the years about hockey returning here, what would that look like? What kinds of threads would you have to gather together to create a tapestry that might allow the NHL to come back here for a third time? I don't think there's any doubt that having TNT headquartered here, I think, along with ESPN, they have created a really nice dynamic With all due respect to NBC and NBC Sports, the previous national broadcaster here, I think having the two, and in some ways they compete, of course they do, right? But the two distinct national entities here in the United States is important. I think it's been important for the game. And the fact that they're here in Atlanta cannot be disregarded. I think there are a lot of things about Atlanta, though, that, you know, A, they were true when Atlanta was here and when they left in the summer of 2011, but have become even more true. And that is the population growth here is enormous. It is a very diverse ethnic community. I read some stats. They're talking about possibly 8 million people in the greater Atlanta area by 2050. Those things have always been true, but the population continues to grow. It's a corporate center. I think there are 19 Fortune 500 companies that have their headquarters or some sort of, you know, prominent presence here in the Atlanta area. So this notion of who would support this team, who would buy the corporate properties and the suites and the naming rights, all those things, you know, those are really enticing. It's a number five or six or six or seven media markets in the United States. It's shocking on some levels that there isn't a team in Atlanta and that there hasn't been a successful team here. And it goes back to a couple, you know, completely critical factors: poor disinterested ownership and an arena far removed from your hockey market. And, you know, if you correct those two vital elements, I don't think there's any reason that there shouldn't be a successful NHL presence here in Atlanta.
Well, let me pick up on that, because, you know, one of the questions that, I mean, I'm sure you get this. I mean, you talk about this on a consistent basis here. Whenever I'm in a conversation about the future of the NHL in Atlanta, one of the things that gets asked early is there an appetite for hockey there? We know there certainly is for football, basketball, baseball, etc. What is, as you understand it now, the appetite for hockey in Atlanta?
Yeah, I don't know. How do you define, you know, that important question? I think there's a significant appetite for it. I'll give you, a decent example. 5 or 6 years ago, the Atlanta United joined the MLS. They actually played out of a college facility to begin with, and then moved into Mercedes-Benz where the NFL Falcons play. It was like, anybody who asked me, and not that anyone cared my opinion on soccer, I was like, no chance this team has any success here, right? It's a weird sports town. All those things that have plagued, you know, the Thrashers, and at various times have plagued, you know, different sports groups here. You know, the Braves moved out of downtown, all those things. And yet the Atlanta United have become a roaring success, and they're a roaring success for a variety of reasons. A, you had ownership who paid attention to this team and its market. How was it marketed? How did you connect with the fan base? And they had success early on. And, you know, that's, you know, it's sort of a, you know, does the same kind of dynamic exist for a future NHL team? I think it does. And, you know, I've been in Atlanta a long time. I've, you know, covered national elements of the game for a long time, you know, 20 years or so since I've been here. But I was also a hockey dad. I coached for 1 year. I owned a pair of skates, ergo qualified to help coach my son's team 1 year. There is a hockey community here. There's an ECHL team that's done very well. There is youth hockey here.
That's true.
It exists. There are fans who are, you know, who would love to go into NHL games if you had an ownership group that understood how to service that fan base. And again, you go back to what happened here with the Thrashers. It was an ownership group that either did not care or did not care to learn how to service the fan base in an arena far away. And so when it came time for them to move to Winnipeg, Ansa Carter tells me the story, talked to former mayor Kasim Reed, and Kasim Reed told Ansa Carter, well, it's not really a hockey town, or we don't support hockey here in Atlanta. And I think Anson's point as part of this, you know, this move to bring NHL hockey back here is that's probably not an informed perspective. You got to do the right things. You've got to bring in youth hockey. You've got to talk to the college club hockey teams. You've got to talk to women's hockey groups. You've got to grow, you know, the game. You've got to make it accessible, all those things. But those are things that the NHL has been, you know, pounding the table, hoping to do. You know, I think they've done a nice job in Vegas, and they're doing a nice job of that in Seattle and in places like Florida and Arizona and LA. So it can be done. You just have to have the commitment to do it. So I am going to get back to your question. What's the appetite for it here? I think if it's done properly with proper ownership who understands, and Anson Carter's, you know, his motto is a hockey first ownership group. And I'm sure the second group has right. that same motto or that same belief. But you got to commit to it, and you got to really believe it and want to support it. So I think the appetite would be enormous, but you have to do it right. And it wasn't done right here when the Thrashers were here. And I understand why there's a lot of skepticism about whether it would work a third time.
A couple of things there. So I had Don Waddell on the program last week, former general manager of the Atlanta Thrashers, now with the Carolina Hurricanes, of course. And that is one of the things he talked about, how, you know, the Thrashers ownership group was, you know, they didn't have as much interest in hockey as they had in other sports. And by the end, we know how it, you know, how it went, and everybody was feuding. And then by the end, they just threw the keys on the table, and Winnipeg came in to save the day, and Atlanta was off to Manitoba. The one person I'm curious through all of this, and we know a lot about Anson Carter, and we're starting to know more about the Alpharetta group, and you mentioned Vernon Krause as well. The one person, I'm glad you had him in your piece at sportsnet.ca, the one person that I wonder about through all of this, who's always maintained that hockey can work in Atlanta, and we know him now most recently with the PWHL, is Stan Kasten. And yeah. you know Stan, you've probably known him for a long time. He is a wonderful marketer. He is a wonderful hype man. And he's already done a lot of good in the PWHL. Have you heard his name attached to any of this?
I haven't. And as you know, he and I traded. He was in Japan with the start of the MLB season. We didn't actually speak on the phone. We traded a bunch of texts. And when I was, asking questions about it and his perspective, and you're absolutely right, I think it's fascinating in this. I have not heard his name here. But I think that's the interesting part as you move forward. And, you know, I don't know how this is going to unfold. You know, a lot of factors. You know, how do you move forward, especially when you're talking about two groups who are really, from ground one, right? Square one. So we're not talking Salt Lake City that has a building. Yeah. We're not talking Houston that has a building. Winnipeg had a building. Mm-hmm. So this is a little different dynamic. But I thought it was, you know, my sense of it is Stan Kasten doesn't have a dog in this fight. Not right now, maybe not ever. But as somebody, you know, who is a longtime Atlantan, I thought that he was unequivocal. It can and it would work here as long as you take care of the things that, you know, we've been talking about. Is your arena in the right spot, meaning closer to your hockey community? Yeah. Both these proposals would have that. And do you have ownership committed to it? And again, and I think, you know, as he talked about some of the other things, the marketing and the grassroots, those are things that you would ask of Seattle and Vegas and anyone else who's going to walk through the NHL door. You would have to answer those questions in the affirmative anyway. I think it's different in Atlanta because of the failures here. And there is, listen, that baggage is something that whoever emerges, Anson Carter's group in Alpharetta, the group in Forsyth County at a place they're calling The Gathering, you have to deal with the baggage. That's the reality here. So I don't think it diminishes the potential in the community and the potential for success of a new NHL team here, but you have to be prepared to answer the questions about someone else's failings. And that may not be fair, but it is going to be the reality moving forward if there's going to be hockey here.
As I wrap up with you, one of the things, Scotty, that whenever I'm asked, you know, what's different now? And like I said, you're there, I'm not. I can't speak with the authority that you can. But the one thing that I'm quite comfortable speaking about with authority is what's different now is the expansion draft rules, or are the expansion draft rules. And that has changed so much, and it's allowed expansion teams to be competitive right away, which has in turn driven up the price. Like, this next round of expansion, like, we're talking about $1 billion here. Like, we're going to look at Vegas and say, wow, what a bargain. We'll look at Seattle and say, wow, what a bargain. Because what they did, again, outside of the salary cap, and as far as, like, driving revenues for the league, the expansion, redoing the expansion rules where you don't have to wander in the desert for 10 years until you can have some type of credibility as an NHL team. Like, the way that they've done it, you can be competitive right away. You don't just draft, you know, the cast-offs from teams and then, you know, showcase your first-round pick. Now you have a competitive team right off the hop. That is, for me, one of the main factors here. Do you have a thought on how the expansion draft rules now have changed everything?
Yeah, there's no question. And you know, you can, I'm sure people in Columbus are like, geez, if we had those rules, maybe we wouldn't, we wouldn't have had the struggles we've had in Columbus or whatever. But, and you're absolutely right. And again, it's critical if you're coming back here, just as I think it would be critical in Houston and in Salt Lake City, you want to have success right away. I mean, would you like to have Vegas success? Sure. But no, to be able to ice a competitive team sooner than later is an absolute game changer. And I think it's only fair, right? When we're talking about the money that initially that the Vegas had to fork out and then the group in Seattle, you have to give them something for that. And so I think that's really important. It does put a lot of pressure on your group as it's being built. You know, I think of George McPhee going to Vegas really early on and talking to George about, you know, how do you do this, right? And, you know, boy, there's the blueprint right there. Ron Francis followed a little different group, you know, track in Seattle. But it's so important, whether it's the Forsyth group, whether it's Anson Carter's group in Alpharetta, you have to have the right people right from the get-go, and you cannot make mistakes. So yes, the door opens immediately for you to be successful here and to really seize on, hey, we're back and we are doing this right and we care about hockey and we're going to build something meaningful and long lasting. But yeah, you get some wins early on, that would be critical. And the plate is, you know, the table is set for that kind of thing to happen, not just here in Atlanta, but wherever the NHL decides to go, if they decide to go on from 32 teams.
Excellent points. You can read Scott's latest, Could the NHL Thrive in Atlanta on a Third Attempt, available at sportsnet.ca. Scotty, always great catching up. Thanks for sharing your expertise with me today.
Anytime.
There he is, the great Scott Burnside. Check out his latest at sportsnet.ca. This segment of the Jeff Merrick Show is brought to you by Hyundai. The 2024 Santa Fe Hybrid NHL Edition is made for those who drive hockey. Only 500 available. Order yours today. I want to thank Scott Burnside for stopping by the program today. I want to thank Kevin Cheveldayoff, Winnipeg Jets general manager. His Jets are in action tonight against the Nashville Predators. Cheveldayoff will be in consideration for the general manager of the year. Blah, 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 blah. Could win it, too. Thanks to Elliot Friedman, who's in Vancouver. Took in last night's big Vancouver win over the Vegas Golden Knights, of course, from Hockey Night in Canada and the NHL on Sportsnet. Thanks to our crew, Matt Marchese, Lance Kennedy, and our camera operator, James Wilson. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks so much for watching. Thanks so much for downloading. Thanks for sharing your attention today. Much appreciated. We're back tomorrow live across the Sportsnet Radio Network, Sportsnet 360 as well, starting at noon Eastern. Enjoy the games tonight. Talk to you tomorrow.